And we should start at the beginning here. Artificial intelligence is not really one thing. There are flavors of it leading up to what we call the generative. But tell us maybe a quick survey of the AI types of systems that are out there.
Yeah, happy to do so. I mean, I always think of the boundary between computer science and artificial intelligence is very fuzzy. It's really, we're talking about computing in a very general way when we're talking about AI. But within AI, traditionally there have been systems that are known as rule-based systems, where basically people author a set of rules and then the system follows these rules. It's kind of a form of programming. And more recently, the emphasis has been on machine learning systems, where the programs essentially write themselves using collected data.
So in the planning for the deployment of AI, then an algorithm is a self-learning module. But how does that relate to what we're hearing so much about these days, the, I guess, large language model types of programs? What are those exactly? How do they differ from traditional AI?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the context of machine learning, there are a specific type of machine learning that's known as neural networks or sometimes deep networks. And these are a very specific kind of program that involves making very simple little tests and responding to those little tests. And what's nice about them, what's sort of brilliant about them, is that you can configure them at a very large scale and then use data to have them set their own parameters so that they work somewhat autonomously, right? So instead of a person saying, okay, if you want to tell the difference between a pug and a Doberman Pinscher, you need to measure the length of the snout, and then if it's less than this, but it's greater than that, people would have to write those rules. So instead of doing that, you just create this big kind of empty structure that is going to be tuned to actually produce the kinds of decisions that you need. And that's all done by feeding it with data and then tweaking these parameters to make them more consistent with what the data shows.
I think sometimes the word intelligence maybe is confusing to people because at the heart of it, it's still if, then, and logic, correct?
Yeah, though if you go back to the Greeks, like that was their they believed that was sort of the essence of what human intelligence was anyway. So it's, what is intelligence? It's what people do. It's a fuzzy thing to try to describe. But these systems, what makes them intelligent and not intelligent? What makes them intelligent is the idea that they're actually able to solve problems that we don't know how to build systems to solve in any other way, right? So again, they can recognize different kinds of animals. They can recognize when a system maybe is about to fail. It has a kind of a form of judgment, and that feels like intelligence. And then, as you say, on the other side, they're also just dumb computing rules. Like at the end of the day, it's just a machine that's following its programming. It's just that the program can be very sophisticated.
And the generative, then, how does that fit into the picture?
Yeah, so in the field, traditionally, generative meant something, but it's come to mean something in the general public that's a little different. So what it means now is systems that can actually produce content. They can produce output. They can produce audio. They can produce images. They can produce text, video, anything that is an AI system that is programmed to produce content like that is now referred to as a generative system.
And what is the term large language model?
Right. So a language model is just a technical term that means the ability to predict future words given context. And this is a really important thing to do because if you say in the old days we used to try to build either speech recognition systems or optical character recognition systems that you could take a picture of text and it would tell you what words were in it. It turns out if you go from the image to the letters just one letter at a time, it ends up being highly inaccurate. There's all sorts of mistakes that it tends to make. So it needs more context. It needs the ability to predict, oh, well, you know, the other day I was walking down the street is a better fit than cupcake in that context, mm-hmm. right? So even if they might be mixed up for each other, the ability to predict the next word is really powerful. So that's what a language model does. A large language model is a language model that's really large. So basically, it consists of billions of parameters, billions of tunable knobs that are used to make predictions as to what word ought to come next given the context.
Yeah, there was a large computing company a few years ago that developed a system where they would take a domain, say a medical domain or maybe a mechanical engineering domain, and put all of the literature that they could identify, millions of pages, into their system. And then within that domain, it could do, they said, predictive analysis. That's the kind of thing we're talking about?
Yeah, it's applied to language in this case when you're talking about a large language model. And the kind of surprising result, surprising to many of us, maybe not everybody, was that if you have something that's good enough at predicting the next word, it kind of looks smart. It kind of looks like it can have a conversation because the context that it's given is the conversation up to this point. The next word that it's predicting is essentially the next word that it would say if it were in that conversation. And that was just kind of remarkable that once these systems hit a certain level of accuracy in terms of predictions, they started to be able to have conversations.
Interesting. You know, in the modern vernacular, that could get you into trouble. Look how many times people use the expression, they'll make a declarative statement followed by the word not, meaning that's not what I meant. So it's hard to imagine these large language models could predict the vernacular cultural part.
You're absolutely right. And I think for decades and decades, it was the case that the language models would be very simple. They'd be use like two or three words. And so something like not that appeared at the end of the sentence, or in German where you like put the verb, the important words at the end of the sentence, they were real challenge for these kinds of systems. But what's remarkable now is the context that they're using to predict the next word is thousands of words. So it really has a lot in its quote-unquote head when it's deciding what to say the next word. And the result of that is that it is quite fluent. It can use vernacular expressions. It can use very long, complicated expressions with ease.
And I'm thinking, too, in the area of translation, which is an ever-changing, ever-evolving field. As you mentioned, German has a certain construction. French puts words in reverse order than we do in English and this kind of thing. So it sounds like we might be on the cusp of a revolution in translation, maybe.
It's definitely happening. And one of the things I think not a lot of people know is that the roots of – so when people say ChatGPT, what's GPT? It stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. Okay, well, what's a transformer? Transformer is a big neural network with a particular structure that was originally invented to transform from one language to another. So language translation was, in fact, the target application of this system. And then people started to play with it and realized, oh, wait, it can, even within a single language, it does remarkable things.
And that gets to the danger of these systems is that you can also corrupt them and, in a sense, have them multiply by fractions and get worse and worse results if they're not fed, so to speak, in the right way.
It's definitely the case that the systems themselves are very dependent on the data that they're trained in. In fact, that's a thing that we're trying to desperately understand now from a research perspective, is how much of this is the transformer network being like just a smart architecture, and how much of it is the architecture doesn't really matter. When you train on a trillion words of language, you're going to start to pick up on patterns that are very deep and very important. And maybe it's the data itself that matters. Now, if that's the case, then yeah, we got to be really careful about the data that we put into these things, because if it's all sort of toxic hate speech, then the language model is going to learn to produce toxic hate speech. It's just doing what it was trained.
I had a parrot that did that once and kind of embarrassed us in front of the neighbors all the time.
It's funny that you mentioned parrots. Within the field, sometimes people refer to large language models as stochastic parrots, basically systems that take in a whole lot of text and spit it back out with some randomness. And so it's a denigrating word that people sometimes use.
And Polly was ahead of her time. And just getting down to the practical here, you have stated your thesis that if a problem, and now we're getting to, say, federal application of this type of technology, if you have trouble stating the problem that you're trying to solve with AI, maybe AI can't solve it for you. Tell us more about that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, of course, what everybody is noticing is that these systems really do seem to be very powerful, and there's plenty of examples of people solving problems that were unsolved for 50 years are suddenly like, oh, we can do that now. And so, of course, what that triggers in everybody else's minds is, wait, I've got problems that I need solved. Maybe this is a really good way of attacking it. And I think that's a good instinct. That's a good impulse to try to follow up on. But you have to keep in mind that even the examples that caught people's attention in the first place, they required a lot of engineers working really, really hard to make the progress that they made. The neural networks, the machine learning, the AI, that played an important role. But people also play a really important role in solving these problems. And so what I like to say is if you've got a problem that's really tough and you think, wow, this is hard, I really need AI to help me solve this problem, it's not going to be the case that you can just push a button and AI will solve it alone. It's going to be some kind of a interaction between the experts who know about this problem and know what needs to be done and this new technology that can help support them.
And for federal agencies, often have the issue of simply wanting to make a business process more efficient, which might already involve automation systems in the first place. I don't think there's anything left that in some way is not touched by a IT system. And so in doing that, then what are the challenges to figuring out how AI can help when you know what the inputs and the outputs desired for that process are?
Yeah, that's right. So I think the important thing to keep in mind is that when you build some kind of infrastructure system that's supporting the operations in your organization, you're going to be frustrated by computers because they don't use good judgment. They don't use judgment at all. They just follow the rules that they're given. And so when you see this new technology that says, wait a second, it kind of has a form of judgment. We could actually be using this to make decisions that are otherwise difficult to make. That's true. But it's a double-edged sword, right? Because things that follow rules means that you can set up the rules and it will follow the rules. And then you can point to that and say, okay, I know why it did that thing. It's because of the rules that we gave it, as opposed to some of these learning-based systems where you get them running, you get them to do what they do, and they make these remarkably apt conclusions sometimes. And then sometimes it's a real, like, head-scratcher. And you're left trying to figure out, well, why? Why did it do what it did the way that it did it? And probably it's traceable to some interesting little bit of data or some connection that it made that it wasn't so obvious or wasn't what a person would have done. And sometimes it's just plain wrong. And so that's kind of the double-edged sword. We can get to a system that can apply judgment, but the judgment is a little bit inscrutable.
And that's a big question, you know, in the military context originally is where I heard this, but now you hear it pretty much from everyone. How can I have my AI be, I guess, fathomable, transparent and explainable and therefore correctable? And how do you build that into a system that is self-operating?
Right. And trustworthy is another word that gets thrown around a lot in this context. It is a big challenge right now. And I think one of the things that we're doing at the National Science Foundation is trying to support researchers who want to get to the bottom of these systems, right? Not just to demonstrate the remarkable capabilities that they're capable of generating, but to say, okay, what is actually generating that? What is making that work? And so the first step is we as scientists need to understand this. So you talk about explainable systems that eventually down the road, we want these systems to be able to explain themselves to the people who are depending on them, which are not necessarily technical experts. But at the moment, even the technical experts are very much in the dark as to what processes these networks are following to do the remarkable things that they're doing. And so that's really where our emphasis is. Well, we're concentrating on both of those, but to me, I think the real first step is, can any of us understand this before we can make it so that everybody can understand this?
And in a related area with transparency, I wanted to ask you about the idea of drift, that you can design a system and say with your limited data set or your carefully curated training data set, wow, this is going to make great decisions for us. This will really help speed up this process. But as it gets fed real-world data over time, then even without your knowing it, the results can be biased. I mean that in the most neutral way, or drift from what your plan was. And how do you prevent that? And what are some of the thinking going on there?
That's a fantastic question. So this is something that's very much on our minds. We actually just got off the ground a new funding program at the National Science Foundation called Safe Learning Enabled Systems. And the emphasis there is on how can we apply what we know about ideas of safety, right? We know how to build safe bridges. We know how to build safe airliners, right? How do we build safe software that isn't just safe when we first deploy it, but remains safe even as it continues to adapt to the data that it's given? And this is an outstanding problem. This is not a solved problem, but we put that challenge out there to the research community, and we've gotten in what appear to be some really fantastic proposals. So hopefully in the next year or so, we'll be able to announce some of the things people are doing there.
It's almost like metal fatigue, in a sense.
Yeah, though, in metal fatigue, you're talking about a bridge over time. Eventually, it starts to give out. Here, the data, the hope is that the data is making it better over time, right? It's metal improvement, exercise, right? But it's not guaranteed, right? How do you put constraints on it so that when it's learning to be better and not learning to become more fatigued and ultimately degraded?
And another place that agencies and any organization is looking to deploy AI is in the chatbot. And this is, again, not a new thing, but what are the dangers there? What are the limitations? And what are some of the progress you've seen?
Right. So these large language models are have proven themselves to be quite remarkable. They're very, very good at language. They're very good at manipulating words, understanding in some sense, or being able to take things that are expressed in very different ways and realize that they're really the same thing. And so that's fantastic. That could really revolutionize the way people interact with computers. I think what people often forget, however, is that they're actually not that smart. Like, they're not problem solvers. They're language users. And they don't even know what they're talking about. They're just really good at talking. And so as a front end to some kind of real database or real system that actually is solving a problem, this is a game changer. This makes it may make it possible for anybody to walk up to the system and start to use it in a reasonable way. But what it's not good at is just inherently solving problems on its own. So I think a lot of people will say things like, hey, we've got this chatbot. Let's ask it how to solve the climate crisis. That's important. Well, okay, that's true. It is important. But at the same time, these systems don't know anything that we don't know. They know about language from having listened to us for a long, long time. They're not super smart otherwise. And so I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind when you apply these. It's a great front end, and I think that's what it's going to be super useful for, but it's not smart.
Right. So that gets back to the notion we talked about earlier. You need to carefully define what you want this system to do and not pretend that it can do that which you can only imagine.
Right. And that's, I think, the big challenge. When you try to bring these kinds of systems to bear on your organization's problems, you need to be thinking about, okay, what are our organization's problems? What kind of solutions do we think are actually relevant and appropriate for us? And then you can apply the AI system and check whether it's actually doing what you want. You can't just wheel the AI system in and say, just start talking to it and like, hey, good to have you here. Fix all our problems. That's not going to work. It's going to lead to tears.
You know, I had a text chat with a retailer that something I was looking for, they didn't have the right size. He said, check this out. I said, no, that's not what I wanted. I want this. He said, well, sign up for our alerts and then we'll let you know when it's in. I said, and by the way, you are a very humanoid chatbot. And I got an answer, oh, no, I'm a person. We don't have chatbots here. This is really a guy named Robert that's answering your question. So you can sort of get yourself fooled in all of this. I thought it might be a good moment to just back up a second and maybe tell us about the range of programs you oversee. What are you trying to do at the National Science Foundation?
Yeah, thanks so much. So I mentioned a couple programs already. The Safe Learning Enabled Systems is one that I am really excited about and hope that it leads to some real improvements in the way these systems are brought to bear. We've been funding AI, I say we, right? So I've been at the National Science Foundation for a little bit over a year, but the National Science Foundation itself has been around for 50-some-odd years. And through much of that history, there's been support for AI machine learning systems that are being built. What's happening now, of course, is that we're trying to respond to this moment, right, where there's a tremendous amount of attention, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity, there's some new vistas to explore. And so we want to make sure that the academic community has the resources that they need to pursue these questions and really answer what society needs them to answer. And so in terms of programs, like specific programs, we have just core programs in my division, in Information and Intelligent Systems. We've got Human-Centered Computing, HCC, which is focused on the human-computer boundary. And of course, there's a lot of work happening there on the human-AI boundary. How do we build these systems so that they interact well with people? The III program is another core program that we've got that focuses in on information integration and informatics. And they're focused on, for many years, they focus on the question of how do we bring this technology to bear to solve actual problems in the world. So that's where their expertise tends to lie. Understanding data, how do you bring data to bear? And then the Robust Intelligence core program is about what we think of as being core artificial intelligence and machine learning, the people who are developing the core algorithms that actually make these things run and understanding their limitations, understanding where the power is in these systems. And so these are just the core programs. Then we have a lot of programs that we've spun up to address particular problems that have come up in AI and computer security.
And one of the questions is the data itself that you mentioned. And I think initially people thought, well, the more the data, the better for training. But it may turn out that small data can be really powerful in training it correctly, an algorithm.
Yeah, this is a lesson that we learned very much from our colleagues in another directorate, SBE, Social Behavioral Economics. Right. So the social science people at the National Science Foundation remind us, you know, we the technologists, we the computing people who will sometimes get very enamored of the things that we're creating, remind us, yeah, this is only a fraction of what people are able to do. People can learn much more sophisticated things with much less exposure. What are they doing? What are you not doing? And so that is a great lesson that we try to stay connected with them and collaborate with them, because they remind us of what's actually possible.
Yeah, because, you know, this came up in the bias context. If you train an algorithm for facial recognition or something, and you use 10,000 faces and they're all white, then you're going to get one kind of output. Whereas if you have 20 of each of six different color faces, so to speak, you're going to get much better training with 120 faces than with 1,000 same faces.
Yeah, you're right. This is something that we understand both from the mathematical standpoint, but also from the social science standpoint. They all kind of agree that this is the phenomenon that you get. If you train with biased or data that doesn't really cover the space particularly well, then these systems are going to fall into traps. They're going to take shortcuts because they're lazy. Fundamentally, these are lazy systems. They're just trying to do what the data tells them they need to do. So if you give them limited data, they're going to be limited systems.
All right. And just bringing it again down to ground level, put yourself in a program manager at the federal level who has processes to do, decisions to make, and there's a relationship between what they deploy to the public at the front end and what happens in the back end. It's really a continuous system. What's the best way to begin thinking about where can AI do me some good here?
Yeah, I think about this question a lot. So it strikes me that, first of all, it's important that everybody become familiar with the tools and what they are and what they're not. But it can't be the case that everyone has to become a machine learning engineer to do their regular jobs. So we're going to need more experts that are shared across organizations so that we can pool some of that expertise, create systems that are more generally useful. And then the individual program managers who are trying to do what they're trying to do can tailor or tweak it or blend it in with the processes that they've got. That seems to me to be the pathway. I don't think we can expect everybody to create these systems de novo everywhere all at once.
Right. And so in some ways, that's the classical information technology problem. Do you throw it over the wall and hope MIS 6 months later or a year, I'm using an old-fashioned term, MIS, comes up with what it is you hoped you were going to get? We need to put the understanding of the tools into users and the actual people dealing with it in their hands. And then there's a better coupling with the output that you might get from IT.
Yeah, I feel like we're in the early days here that are maybe comparable to the, I don't know, mid-80s or something like that, when the expertise was not, like the tools weren't all there yet, but there was people who needed the tools. But I feel like back then people were more patient. There was the ability to just say, okay, well, we'll just wait for
MIS.
Oh, so MIS.
Management,
yes, that makes more sense.
Management Information Systems.
To create the systems that you're going to be able to build on. Now, we kind of need them now. And so I think the urgency is up compared to what it was in the past. So I think everybody needs to get on it.
Yeah, I remember when the first people that learned VisiCalc became the priests of their department.
That's exactly right. Yeah, now everybody's got to do Excel or something like it.